So our gospel lesson and text for preaching this morning comes from the 24th chapter of Matthew. I invite you to listen with me again for God's word. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. In our Sunday school class over the past, I guess probably 10 weeks or so, we've been watching this video series called Living the Questions. And it's been this series of themes in Christianity that contemporary scholars have commented upon and perhaps, you know, raised new interesting angles to look at these themes, and we've had some really great discussions on a weekly basis. The last one that we watched this past Sunday was called Debunking the Rapture. And the point that many of the people made, and many of the theologians and scholars in this video made, was that the theology of the rapture, as you know, when the Son of Man comes and some people are taken and some are left and the world kind of falls apart, it is really, really bad theology. And yet, on this Sunday, the first Sunday in Advent, we have this story, and it's the words of Jesus recounting that very scenario. And I think it's confusing, because it's not the story that we think we're going to hear on the first Sunday of Advent when we come to church. And it describes violence and horrific scenarios where people just disappear. And even more troubling, it describes the Son of Man in a way that we don't recognize. This one who comes and wreaks havoc on all of creation looks nothing like the Jesus we know in Scripture. So it is confusing, and it is even more confusing when you think about this being the first Sunday in Advent, and it's the Sunday of hope. What exactly is hopeful about the text that I just read? That's a very good question, and it's one that I'm going to let Nadia Boltz-Weber help us answer this morning. We've also read this book in our fellowship class. It's called Accidental Saints, and it's the account of a year in her ministry in the church that she pastors in Denver, Colorado, called the Church of All Saints and the House of All Saints and Sinners. And the story I'm going to read to you, or portions of the story that I'm going to read to you, are about Nadia Boltz-Weber and one of a kind of skittish, reluctant congregant in her midst named Jim, and this text, and how this text is kind of transformed in their midst. So I'm just going to invite you to listen to her words. When Jim and his boyfriend, Stuart, showed up to church the first Sunday of Advent in 2008, we were only about 30 of us in our small band of Jesus-y misfits. Just that Sunday, we had started to gather weekly rather than monthly for Eucharist. Jim and Stuart had been part of the House of All Saints, Sinners and Saints ever since, and even though the last thing Jim wanted in his life at the time was church, a sentiment to which I can completely relate. Both in their early 40s, Jim was fashionably bald, ginger-bearded, and pretty understated, while Stuart is a tall, funny, larger-than-life occasional drag queen. I loved them both immediately, because even on their very first Sunday, they helped carry the seemingly countless Rubbermaid containers of our church junk upstairs to the little closet where all our church belongings were stored. And I'm a sucker for anyone who is helpful at putting stuff away. The next Sunday, Jim and Stuart came back. And after church, Jim slid into the vinyl booth next to me at Sputnik, which at the time was the post-liturgy bar of choice for House of All. "I'm glad you guys came again this week," I said, trying to sound welcoming but not creepy. "Yeah," Jim replied. "This afternoon, Stuart said, let's go back to that House of All Sinners and Saints." And I was like, "Ugh, seriously?" I laughed out loud because he told me the truth. I thought it was hysterical that someone would sit across from the pastor, order a beer, and say how he hadn't wanted to come back to that pastor's church. Best part was that after I laughed, he didn't try to backpedal. He just laughed with me and added, "I'm just not into church right now." "I get it," I said. And then we moved on to other conversations, mostly involving recent movies. And then about 15 minutes of Jim explaining to me how I could get mail accounts to sync with my, how I could get my mail accounts to sync onto my iPhone. Later, I would learn that Jim had a very good reason to not be into church. During a 9-year period when he was struggling with his identity, Jim had worked on the staff at a premier evangelical megachurch outside Chicago, which had actually been a refreshing change from what Jim had been immersed in as a child. He was raised a conservative Baptist. After I learned about his upbringing, I knew why. On that first Sunday that he and Stuart had come to worship, he squirmed through the reading of the gospel, a reading that included lines like, "Some will be taken." I could see him shifting his feet, crossing his arms, and I think I even heard him sigh. Of course, Jim was raised in a church that believed in the rapture. I myself had never heard of the rapture until I was well into my 30s. My fundamentalist upbringing was simply too Bible-believing to go in for that particular kind of crazy, since the rapture was an idea that some preacher in the UK came up with in the late 19th century. When it comes down to it, folks can take a couple of verses in the Bible and run any direction they want with them, including the direction of a multi-million dollar publishing deal if you're Tim LaHaye, author of the Left Behind series. Sure, there are a couple of references to some being taken and some not, but in my reading of it, the rapture itself is not really in the Bible. I'm certain there are more gracious ways of explaining the rapture, and not everyone who believes in it fits this description, but to believe in the rapture feels to me like it's the same as believing that when Jesus comes back, he will do so as a judgmental, angry man who apparently underwent a total personality transplant since his resurrection. Or as a selective magician who will make all the good people float up to the sky like a million evangelical Mary Poppinses and force the bad people to be, quote, left behind, unquote, on earth to suffer terribly. She goes on to talk more about apocalyptic Bible literature and the rapture, and then she comes back around to that first Sunday in Advent and reads the text that I just read as a part of what Jim had to listen to on that Sunday. And then she says this, "In other words, I had to preach on a text that my friend Russell describes as the anticipated threat of Jesus kidnapping someone at work and then breaking into my house and robbing me." The weird thing about that little passage from Matthew is that it has been used by so many as a prediction of the end of times or as an all-encompassing field guide for how to be ready for Jesus' return, how to know for sure that you will be raptured and not left behind. But given the number of incorrect end time predictions that have been over the centuries, even in my lifetime, there may have been more to be learned by reading texts like this as descriptive and not predictive. If we are looking for certainty about the future from the Bible, this might be just about the worst place in the world to look for it. No one knows, the text indicates. The angels don't know. Jesus doesn't know. You don't know. If the guy knew when the thief was coming, he wouldn't have gotten his stuff stolen. So be ready, because it's unexpected. But how the heck can you be ready for something when you don't know it's coming? How can we be ready for the unexpected? Well, we can't. So maybe being awake and alert and expectant, all themes of Advent, has nothing to do with knowing or with certainty or prediction, but has a lot to do with being in a state of unknowing. My instinct is to always use my knowingness, my certainty I'm right, like how I'm so clearly 100% right about the rapture being a made-up thing, as a sort of loss prevention program, a system by which I protect myself from the unknown and the unexpected, which works approximately none of the time. Perhaps, like how Jim was certain, he never wanted anything to do with church ever again. Here's the thing. Like the house owner, knowing what to look for as a way of avoiding being robbed is only advantageous if we assume being robbed is a bad thing. But perhaps having an unknowing brain allows us to be taken unaware by the grace of God, which is like a thief in the night. Maybe it's good news that Jesus had been staking out the joint and there will be a break-in. The promise of Advent is that in the absence of knowing everything, we get robbed. There was and is and will be a break-in, because God is not interested in our loss prevention programs, but in saving us from ourselves and saving us from a culture and saving us even from certainties about God's story itself. This holy thief wants to steal from us, and maybe that is literal and metaphoric at the same time. Perhaps during Advent, a season with incredible levels of consumption in which our credit card debt rises and our waistbands expand, the idea that Jesus wants to break in and jack some of our stuff off is really good news. There's just a whole lot of crap in my house, again, both literal and metaphorical, that I could well do without. So on that Sunday in 2008, despite his shifting feet and desire not to be in church, Jim came to the house of all to listen to me preach. And I suggested that maybe we should all start making Advent lists. They'd be like Christmas lists, but instead of listing the things we want Santa to bring us, we could write down the things that we want Christ to break in and take from us. In the hopes that he could pickpocket the stupid junk in our houses or abscond with the self-loathing or resentment. Maybe break in the middle of the night and take off with our compulsive eating or our love of money. That's how God works sometimes. Not through the things that we are prepared for, but through the things we don't expect. So I kind of think it's a good thing that we start off this first Sunday in Advent a little bit on edge. So we think we know what's coming. So being reminded from the get-go that we really don't opens us up to the possibility that Christ may really break into our lives, our real lives, in a way that we don't expect, and not just is a part of a narrative, a Christmas narrative that we've come to know so well. So my question to you is, what would be on your Advent list? What do you want Christ to break in and take from you? Because that is how God works sometimes. And our certainty can very well be our downfall. So maybe the invitation and the hope, yes, the hope on this first Sunday of Advent is that we might be a little less certain because we don't want to miss the one who, we don't want to miss the one or the very thing or the very person that promises to come and set us free. So friends, I invite us now to take some time and sing our way into that expectation and that hope we have for this season. We're going to share in a little bit of a hymn sing.